So while some of the stories of the last few weeks have been about uncertainty in faith or understanding of God, this story that we're going to share today, our story, is a little different than that. Our journey to becoming a foster family was lined with uncertainty, as all foster care journeys are. In fact, we knew what we were signing up for, though what the uncertainty would actually feel like is something altogether different, and we still held hands and jumped in. So that's why I asked Christina to help me share this morning, since it's really our story together. So today, instead of just regurgitating our foster care story, which we love to tell as often as possible, we want to tackle uncertainty from a different angle as we try to describe what it has looked like for us to keep moving forward. Because sometimes it's not necessarily our faith framework or view of God or relationships with the church that have become shaky or crumbly. Sometimes instead, our uncertainty is about what our future days and weeks and months and years hold. And that was so very true for us. The very nature of this path meant we'd be adjusting all the time to this system we were submitting ourselves to for the sake of some unknown kiddos and our call to be faithful to what we felt God had asked us to do. And while we signed up for some uncertainty, maybe you didn't. Maybe you were playing by the rules and life threw garbage at you that you could never have anticipated. Illness, job loss, crumbled relationships, homelessness, death of a loved one. Wherever you find yourself this morning, we hope that you'll be able to hear some part of our own ongoing journey of uncertainty, and you'll find yourself able to say with us, yes, same here. I've been there too. So how do we find the beauty amidst the ashes? The act of remembering God's work in our lives. We do this sometimes without even noticing that we're reflecting upon God's faithfulness. We can build muscles for faith, trust, celebration, and tell that story, bring that story to mind, rather than only focusing on the failures of the past, or the limits of our stories in their future context, or the ways that things have fallen apart. Throughout the Old Testament, God encourages his people to remember their own lives and the lives of the ones who have gone before them. This powerful practice of remembering and telling our stories is described like this in Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all of your soul, with all of your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you a land with large flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery.
I'm going to keep sitting, even if this is awkward for everyone. Later we see God instructing Joshua to remember God's work among his people. And this is from Joshua 4, and it's a little bit long, but stick with me. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you, and put them down at the place where you stay tonight. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, as the Lord had told Joshua, and they carried them over with them to the camp where they put them down. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. Now the priests who carried the ark remained standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything the Lord had commanded Joshua was done by the people, just as Moses had directed Joshua. The people hurried over, and as soon as all of them had crossed, the ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side while the people watched. The men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over, ready for battle in front of the Israelites as Moses had directed them. About 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. That day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him all the days of his life, just as they had stood in awe of Moses. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Command the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant law to come out of the Jordan." So Joshua commanded the priests, "Come up out of the Jordan." And the priests came up out of the river carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And no sooner had they set their feet on the dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran at flood stage as before. On the tenth day of the first month, the people went from the Jordan, camped at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho, and Joshua set up the Gilgal, the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. He said to the Israelites, "In the future, when your descendants ask their parents, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them, 'Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God.'" This remembering is not denying the hard parts or the intricacies of our stories. This is not saying it's been a smooth, clearly paved road. Sometimes remembering the past calls us to look at the dust that's swirling behind us, wait for the dust to settle so that we can see the road and what it actually looks like. So what does this remembering look like for us? Well, it looks like talking about our story and mining through the experiences of it. When we are in the midst of uncertainty, it's amazing if we can notice the Spirit's movement. And sometimes this happens. But often we are so caught up in the day-to-day happenings, the anxieties around each corner, and the wonderings of what is going to happen that we don't notice the way God is still faithfully present. When I look back on our times of uncertainty, I can see that in each season, God met us there. And often those meetings and moments came through people, his church, being God to us. I hope you'll hear our hearts, that we're working out what it means to follow Jesus in the midst of a life that is full of the unexpected. So let me pray for us as we dive into a little more of what we've been learning. God, today as we gather in this room together, may your Spirit illuminate the parts of our journeys that you'd like to highlight today. May we sense your gentle guidance as you speak through our stories. May we see your faithful presence in the darkest corners of our lives, the corners we've turned away from, sometimes wondering where you were. May we notice your continued faithfulness in this moment today. Amen.
It was the end of 2012. I was preparing to drive back to Tulsa after spending Christmas in Illinois with our families. My wife was crying, yet again, as we departed from her parents' driveway. We engage in the familiar conversation. Will we move back to Illinois eventually, or stay with our friends and church family in Oklahoma? We'd already felt the call to foster, and we had had a hard time imagining doing that so far away from family support. We began to, once again, consider the possible jobs, the probable cities, and we prayed for the kiddos who may one day join our family through foster care. We got back to Tulsa and settled into the familiar rhythms. I loved my job, and so did she. We spent time with friends and went back to life as usual. Then it was February. I got a text from my brother. His church was opening up an associate pastor position. I stopped to ponder the seemingly randomness of that message and wondered if it wasn't so random. I shared this with Christina.
I saw him come into the kitchen. He looked subtly excited, and I asked him immediately, "What's going on?" I mean, that's as much as you get.
Always subtly excited.
Exactly. He shared the text, and I felt my heart leap. There it is. I heard it so clearly, I felt, and I wondered if it was me or is that the Spirit's small, still voice. Things moved pretty quickly. The job description fit him so well, and I could see him come alive when he read it. I wondered if we should tell our closest friends, but realized the complications since they were part of our church as well. We stayed quiet for a few weeks, but began to feel too excited and too uneasy to continue to hold back such a big part of our life. I went back to work and stepped into my boss's office, and Dustin joined me. We were uncertain if this would be a huge misstep to reveal a job opportunity to our current employer. But he wasn't just a boss. He was our friend, and we wanted to be honest with him. And most importantly, we wanted the church to continue to flourish, and we knew that it would take some time to train people to backfill the positions that we were in.
So I had applied for a job in Illinois while still serving on staff at a church that I loved. I wondered if my whole life was about to change, and I felt uneasy about the speed at which it all began to progress. I wondered if I should tell my boss, my pastor, my friend about the possibilities that were unfolding behind the scenes. And I felt a little uneasy about keeping the information to myself. So together we decided to talk to him. We shared the news and waited for his response. He listened well, asked questions, supported and encouraged us, and seemed sad. We left his office and knew that things were different now. We wondered if I'd get the new job or if I'd just put the job I currently had on the line for no reason. Had we jumped the gun and shared too much? Well, I think we know this part of the story. We left our house, dear friends, our college town, our first ministry positions, yada, yada, yada. We started the new job, lived closer to family, formed new relationships, many of which are in this room, filled out way too much paperwork, signed up for pride classes, prepared friends and family on what to expect, bought a house, yada, 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 all with the same risky purpose in mind.
So we're jumping ahead. I got a call from our foster care agency, and my heart fluttered and my stomach turned like it did each time the phone would ring from that number. Could this be the call that would change things forever? I heard our licensing worker's voice on the line, asking if we'd like to be placed with three children, two girls and their older brother, and I paused for a second, but knew that three wasn't the plan. I said no, with the caveat that we might reconsider if they couldn't find anyone else. We knew that it would be well beyond our capacity to go from zero to three kids overnight, and it was beyond our capacity to go from zero to two, turns out. But here we are. But I felt different during that phone call than I had before. And I moved on with my day and didn't hear back from the agency. A week passed, I got another call, same number, same voice. It's about the same kiddos, she said. The brother is now going to stay at his current foster placement, but they were looking for another spot for the girls. The girls were 3.5 and almost 5. What did I think? I immediately said, I don't want to split the siblings. They'd be better together. But she said they would be split anyway. And they'd be giving us an opportunity to at least keep the girls together. We said yes. We began to prepare, and nothing about this process was feeling like what we thought it would be. They were coming from a good home, and they were leaving their brother behind. We'd signed up for uncertainty, but this wasn't something we'd thought through all the way.
We wondered, are we adding to the brokenness or helping making things better? Is this really the best solution? Is there not another way? We went over to that foster family's home and met two precious, sweet, and hyper, think anxious, girls. We met the people who have been caring for these three siblings for more than a year already. We met the girl's brother and felt slightly more at ease that we could keep up relationship between the siblings by meeting together with this other foster family regularly. Birthday parties, parks, museums, Chick-fil-A, and McDonald's. It didn't matter where, just as long as we could sustain their sense of connection to each other and maintain a sense of stability. Now our life is forever intertwined with people who are different than you are. We don't vote the same way. We don't view parenting the same way. We don't really think about much of the world in the same way. But our shared love of these three kids is more important than that. And our love for Jesus that compelled both of our families to become foster and now adoptive parents is bigger than those myriad of reasons we'd have to break relationship and say, it isn't worth it. It is hard at times because no one really walks you through the nuances or intricacies of every situation. Heck, they barely prepared us for any of this. Who could? This isn't how life is supposed to go. We knew that we signed up to be a light in a dark, confusing, and frustrating place. And sometimes that means we're working with less than ideals.
In fact, this whole idea of concurrent plans, which is a foster care norm, easily fit into this category of less than ideal, if you asked me. There is truly nothing about a concurrent plan that fits well with my personality. I mean, I love planning, but concurrent planning, having two plans with separate outcomes that are somehow running at the same time, this is something that I would never choose to employ in my own life. It just seemed confusing and hard to follow. But because parents deserve a chance to reunite with their kiddos who have been removed from their care, and those same kiddos need a safe place to stay while their parents are working on those necessary steps, concurrent plans are the lifeblood of foster care. In order to delineate between various steps of the process in foster care, the terminology of goals is used. Children can be on many places on this goal spectrum, from a return home to an adoption goal. So this, what's your current goal, is a common question that is thrown around the foster care world. My goal? I sometimes thought, my goal is to make it through the evening with a smooth bedtime so I can watch an episode of Survivor before I start all of this again tomorrow. Big dreams. So, seriously, the idea of concurrent plans can be the sticky part of foster care that keeps good-hearted, loving families from getting involved. Concurrent planning leads to the question, but what if they leave? Concurrent planning says that they might leave, and yet they also might stay. And this is uncertainty, and it was the water we swam in for almost 3 years with our daughters. All kingdom living is living in the tension of what would be best and what is the best version of reality you can live in with the cards you've actually been dealt. Yes, he makes beautiful things out of the dust, but those aren't perfect things. All of the wrongs aren't made right in their situation, no matter how much we love and support and lavish our love on them for the next 60 years. Their story and ours are marked with cracks and chips and nicks. And just because we can't fully make the story right, as I'd love to do, since I'm a one on the Enneagram and my whole thing is reforming and making things right, this life that pursues the values of the kingdom is still absolutely worth it. Diving into a messier version of foster care than we ever anticipated is still completely and utterly better than sitting on the sidelines and protecting ourselves from the hurt and the pain and the incompleteness of the healing. And isn't that true in life? It's better to dive in, risk hurt and pain, knowing it's inevitable, and still keep living. Keep trying, keep pushing back darkness, and doing our part to make things right.
So back to the story. You welcome two precious girls into your home and family one cold weekend in March. You've been waiting for their arrival, and you feel as ready as you can be for what lies ahead. You start to learn their rhythms and routines while shaping them to fit yours as well. You provide stability. You provide safety. You tuck them in bed and sing them to sleep. You get to know their favorite books and movies and toys. You long to find your rhythm as a parent, but it still feels a lot like babysitting. When will this start feeling normal, you ask? And you begin to navigate a system that is confusing and ever-changing. You answer questions, so many questions, from friends and family and even strangers at the Aldi checkout line, after one of the girls announces their whole life story, of course. What happened to their parents? Will they go back home? Do you get to keep them? And then you answer questions from your girls. You go to a friend's house, and you hear your daughter say, "Can I see my room?" as she assumes she's probably going to be staying there, and perhaps this is her next new home. Uncertainty is commonplace to them, too common. You protect your kids from the fullness of their story while trying to share as much of the truth as you can. You explain what family means and what safe people are like, and why some mommies and daddies aren't able to take care of their children. You wish you had better answers and more solutions. You sit with a caseworker who's overworked and underpaid and ask questions about the future of their case, longing to hear a glimmer of hope in the words they choose to share. You know the hope that you hear may just be their way of keeping you in the game, and you wonder how long it's going to take to understand what's going on.
You lay down your rights, your freedom, your independence, and you submit to something for the greater good. You take your kids to bio-parent visits with someone they may or may not be hoping to see, and you suppress the outrage you feel when that person doesn't show up for the kids that you love. You welcome workers and advocates and random people into your home, some who are checking up on your kids and some who are checking up on you. You wish you could have a normal evening routine. You stress eat. You keep working. You serve at Breakfast Club on Sunday mornings and hear stories of parents who have had kids removed from their home. You listen to the stories around the table and notice that many of the guests spent time in foster care as children. You pray. You go to court and wonder why everything takes so long, why people get so many chances, why Peoria is the slowest of the slow when it comes to finding a way to get these kids and families permanently. You continue to hold the tension of two possible outcomes, believing with everything inside of you that you know what's best, though you have no say. You pray. You wish. You share your hopes and your fears after each new detail of their case is revealed. You find your heart can hold more emotions at one time than you ever knew to be possible. And you keep living. You keep waking up and making breakfast. You buy the girls' clothes in the next size up because they are on sale and it makes sense to think ahead. And you're suddenly overwhelmed with the possibility that they might not be with you the next winter. You cry in the middle of Target, wondering how you'll pick up the pieces if they leave. And you remind yourself that they are God's daughters first and that He has always been with them. And you hold on to that hope as an anchor for your soul.
In fact, you must behave as if they are going to leave while also behaving as if they are going to stay. Let me say that a different way. You must love as if they're going to leave, while also loving as if they're going to stay, which means we simply love. This is the journey of foster care, and I think it's the journey of life. On December 29th of last year, we became a forever family. The endless court dates and paperwork and caseworker visits were finally over. It was a day of celebration and a day that was also extremely ordinary. The girls, who had felt like ours for years, were finally off of the concurrent plan. There was only one plan, and it was us. And now, we might be tempted to feel like we have more control, but there is still so much that we aren't able to will into being. This is the journey of all parenting and really of much of life. The letting go and the leaning in. So we do. We find ways to let go of our expectations, some of which we didn't even know we were carrying. We still don't have control of how our girls will continue to process their pain, how their resilience will continue to develop, or what choices they will make. We don't have control of the everyday moments that trigger big feelings of abandonment, loss, worthlessness, and confusion. We are uncertain of what their future in school looks like, their relationship to substance looks like, their sense of identity will look like. And yet we carry on with a little more certainty than before. We are forever theirs and they are forever ours. That small bit of certainty is the truth we come back to in the midst of behaviors that are so big we know we don't have the ability to handle them on our own. We go back to that truth when the pain and the sadness in our girls bubbles to the surface in ways that other families just might not understand. We hold on to that truth because it reflects the truth that we've had from the beginning of this journey. We are forever God's, and He is forever ours. And we take time to remember.
I remember a particular text message that came in the midst of an incredibly difficult week, one we were shouldering alone and not fully talking about even with our closest friends. And then out of the blue, Summer sent us just a random text cheering us on and reminding us that she saw the good we were doing. I remember a card from our friend Laura, who specifically named the ways she saw me mothering well. After feeling overwhelmed by the newness of it all and the pain of the trauma of our girls that they were carrying and the responsibility to somehow help make things right for them, her words were a healing balm for the parts of me that questioned if I could be enough and if I was the mom they actually needed. I remember our small group, full of friends who were married with no kids, who so quickly welcomed our girls into our group by babysitting for us, listening to the latest updates, and jumping in whenever they could. I remember our friend Elizabeth, an excellent caseworker for a completely different agency who spent so many hours explaining to us the ins and outs of a system we were still learning to navigate and understand. I remember the opportunity we were given to learn from experienced foster and adoptive parents this last spring as we dove into material about trauma-informed parenting that will forever shape our family and the families we continue to know. And I remember those who are praying, both nearby friends and those in other cities. They prayed in ways that didn't have specific outcomes in mind. But instead, they offered the types of prayers that asked for us to be held and sustained, for us to recognize God in the midst of chaos. And I remember moments at the dinner table when our girls would finally share something that was super hard for them. And I remember when we'd see breakthroughs in their learning, or we'd make it to the end of an hour-long meltdown and feel proud of the way we'd handle our own emotions as we were allowed them to fully experience their own. If you're like me, you can easily find time to talk about and look for the failure and limits and ways our stories fall short. We can be accustomed to tuning into uncertainty, to notice the shakiness, the unsteadiness of all the seasons of our life and of this world in general. And this is true. Life is hard, and developing our antenna for uncertainty can be easier than developing our receptivity for faith, trust, and celebration of God's faithfulness. But it can be done. We can begin to see the ways that God has been there in it all. We can begin to think of this life of faith as trust in God. I'm not suggesting we pretend that things are different than reality. And we have had our fair share of days recently that our reality has been too difficult to share. The pain of our girl's story sneaks up on us unexpectedly in the middle of a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and we are all left reeling from the turmoil of it. And yet, we choose to acknowledge the pain and still look for joy. This is the life of faith. Paul writes, "Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, character hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has given to us." So today, I encourage you to take a look at the life you've been living. Whether you felt like your compass has been broken or your heart has been trampled, look for God's hand that may have been extended through God's people. And when you see the cracks or even the gaping holes, notice the places where the light has still gotten in. We are uncertain and seen, uncertain and known, uncertain and held, uncertain and loved. And what was certain? Well, this would be hard. God would be with us. It would be worth it. And we, both our girls and us, would be better for it.